This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Last summer, a sturgeon washed up on Isle Lamont in Lake Champlain. It was 6.5 feet long and estimated to be 73 years old. That caught our attention. We had a sense that these fish lived long and grew large, but this seemed excessive. With a little investigation, you quickly learn there's much more to lake sturgeon than you thought. Age and size, incredible ancestry, unique looks, and one sad truth, they're endangered in Vermont. All that warrants further investigation. And here to help us understand much more about our lake sturgeon is Chet McKenzie. He's Fisheries Program Manager for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Chet, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Rick.
I keep using words like fascinating, interesting, mysterious to describe sturgeon. Let's begin with that ancestry because they have some serious lineage.
Yeah, the sturgeon family has been around for well over 1 million years. So when you think about it, this family of fishes has been here, you know, longer than the dinosaurs. They survived the whatever caused the dinosaurs to disappear, and they're still here. And they're very, very unique looking fish. They're cartilaginous fish, which most fish that we think of are bony fish. This fish has its skeleton made of cartilage. So it's an ancient family of fishes.
Yeah, the look of it, it's almost like you've taken leftover parts of other fish and put them together, kind of like an Aquarian Mr. Potato Head, if you will. Describe it.
Well, I would never describe a sturgeon as a Mr. Potato Head because I happen to think they're a great-looking fish.
They are.
They're very unique for a freshwater fish. You know, to pick up a fish that's covered with a leathery skin instead of scales. They are shaped like a torpedo. They're typically the ones we're dealing with are 4 to 5.5 foot long. They have a pointed snout with barbels that hang off from the bottom of that snout so they can sense food in the substrate in front of them. They have a protrusible mouth that extends out so they can vacuum in food items off the bottom. And to top it all off, they're covered with these bony scutes, armor plates, and then they have a shark-like tail. So they're very unique in terms of what they look like, how they're built for a freshwater fish.
Last summer, that sturgeon that washed up on Isle Lamont, that's an impressive fish. Talk about size, weight, age that sturgeon can reach.
Well, sturgeon can live up to 150 years. The record's been that old. This is the oldest sturgeon we've aged here in Lake Champlain. They can reach 200 pounds. They can certainly get over 7 feet. As I said earlier, most of the fish that we're dealing with are between 4 and 5.5 feet.
And this one was aged at 73 years. How do you tell the age of a sturgeon?
Well, there's a couple of ways to age sturgeon. What we did with this fish was we took a cross-section of its pectoral fin ray, and then you look at that fin ray with a microscope. In this case, we were lucky enough with new technology to blow it up so we could really look for fine marks. Typically, after a sturgeon hits about age 30, it gets relatively difficult to age them. You know, to be within 5 years, I'd be very happy with that. The other way to age them is to look at an otolith, which is an inner ear bone. And again, you would section that and you would count the rings. And we don't do that. The University of Vermont may look at a few otoliths here that we've collected from dead sturgeon, but they haven't had a chance to do that yet either.
We're learning all about lake sturgeon, where they've all gone, what the state is doing to restore their population. What do you want to know about this fish? Have you ever caught one? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We heard from Sylvie. She said, I hope you mentioned the origins of Champ can be traced to Samuel de Champlain discovering a sturgeon in the lake that now bears his name in the summer of 1609. And it does seem like Champ, Magog, even Nessie, a lot of people, you know, these purported sea monsters, in the end, we can kind of say it's probably a sturgeon. Why do people see a sturgeon and think it could be something larger?
Well, I've actually had that happen to me. I was up on the Richelieu River up around the city of Montreal working with their sturgeon crew up there. And sturgeon like to porpoise in the spring when they're into a river spawning like that. So the head of this fish comes out of the water, this pointed-looking head, and then it rolls slowly down the water, and these bony scutes along its spine, these spikes along its spine come out of the water. its dorsal fin is towards the back of the body, which is very different than a lot of other fish. So that finally comes out of the water. And then at the end, it's rolling forward, and this big shark-like tail comes out of the water. It's an optical illusion because you have this flowing water going by, this large fish rolling slowly. The first one I saw, I remember saying to one of the people from Quebec, that must be 10 foot long, and they just laughed because they thought it was a 5 foot sturgeon.
Oh,
so their behavior of rolling at the surface, the fact that very few people have ever seen a sturgeon, and to see something covered with bony scutes and a shark-like tail could easily lead people to think they just saw a prehistoric creature.
For some reason, people, and that means me in particular, think of them as a deep water fish, but apparently I've got that wrong.
Right. Lake sturgeon are bottom feeders. They have that protrusible mouth. They sense the food in the bottom, in the substrate with their barbels. They can also see it. But so where's the most food grown in a lake? It's always in the shallow littoral zone. So lake sturgeon are typically found between 14 and, say, 25 feet of water. That's their history everywhere, not just here in Lake Champlain, but in the last 2 years with our acoustic tracking project, we were able to document that, in fact, that's where these fish stay, in that, you know, 12 to 14 foot out to maybe 30 feet of water.
Why would they find that as their kind of sweet spot, their region they like to stay in?
Well, that's where the sun reaches in the water, so you have more production of insects and, you know, what insects feed on and mollusks, and, you know, they need that light zone in the lake where the productivity is highest, so that's where sturgeon feed.
And you've mentioned their mouth a couple times. It's almost like a Hoover attachment, like a vacuum cleaner. Kind of describe that mouth in a little more detail for people.
Well, that's really what it is. You know, it protrudes out when we actually, to anesthetize them, we actually put a thumb in their mouth and rub the roof of their mouth. But that mouth protrudes out of the bottom of their head, and they use it to suck up food. But then there's these bony ridges across the top of that tube that comes out that they grind food on. So it's pretty unique.
Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call from Jay, who's calling from North Pownal. Jay, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hello. Chet, first of all, I'd kind of like to introduce myself. I'm Jay LeBombard. You would know me by mutual friend Tom Evanoika at the bait shop. I'm the guy who had the camp over at Hewlett's Landing where Tom fished all the time. But I want to say that I've been fascinated by sturgeon from the time I was a child, reading about them in Outdoor Life, et cetera, and all. Do you think there's any chance that sturgeon in Champlain could grow to the size of something comparable to the Russian sturgeon? I'm hearing reports of 400 pounders and maybe even exceeding that in the Hudson River. It's illegal to fish them. But what are your comments on that?
Jay, great question. And also, if you can, Chet, you know, kind of tell us what that difference is between our lake sturgeon and those sturgeon that produce a lot of the world's caviar.
Well, actually, lake sturgeon could produce caviar, and they have been used for caviar in the past. But in particular, what Jay's talking about is the Hudson River. So those larger fish are a different species. They're Atlantic sturgeon. And you'll see pictures in papers or whatever online of these fish that weigh even – that are even larger, that are 12 foot long, weigh 800 pounds. And those are the white sturgeon from the West Coast. So lake sturgeon, the record is the 300-pounder I mentioned earlier. They just don't grow as large as an anadromous sturgeon that go out to the oceans like in the Hudson and come back up, or the white sturgeon found on the West Coast. And the sturgeon in Russia that are used for caviar, almost every sturgeon can be used. You know, their eggs can be used to make caviar. I don't know how the quality compares between a lake sturgeon caviar and a beluga caviar, but they all can be used to make caviar.
So we're just going to have to be content with a 300-pound sturgeon in Lake Champlain being our biggest.
Well, we've never seen one that big. That would certainly be surprising, right?
The lake sturgeon are only found in Lake Champlain in Vermont, but how do they use the lake's tributaries?
They have a very unique life history. It takes a lake sturgeon anywhere from 10 to 15 years for a male to mature and up to 25 years for a female to mature. Once they reach maturity, they use these tributaries, these major tributaries, as spawning sites. So they migrate from the lake up the rivers to usually the first obstruction where there's fast water, flowing water, large stones, cobble that they can spawn on top of. And then they'll spawn in those areas. The eggs are adhesive. The eggs sink down to the bottom and get into that stone I was talking about, that rubble. And then they'll develop in 5 to 10 days. They'll hatch out. Another 5 to 10 days, the larvae will actually come out at night and drift downstream. And the unique one, another unique part about their life history is that those males may only return to spawn once every 2 or 3 years. We're seeing some that return every year. But the females may only return to spawn once every 5 years. So between taking 25 years to mature and then only spawning once every 5 years, you can see why those adults are really critical to the restoration program.
Now, there was a time, Chet, when they were fished commercially in Lake Champlain. So when was that happening?
I don't know exactly when the biggest commercial fisheries occurred, but between 1900 and the 1950s, there were between 50 and 200 lake sturgeon harvested a year that were reported. I think the reporting was seriously underestimating the numbers that were harvested. And the fishery began to decline in the 1950s, the late 1950s and the 1960s. And then it was closed in, I think, around 1967. And then they became listed as an endangered species in 1972.
Do we have any idea back when it was being fished commercially what the population of sturgeon were in the lake?
No, not really. I mean, some people have looked at trying to model those, you know, those catches. You can use a catch at age analysis or a decline in the numbers harvested. But I think there were some real concerns about the fact that reporting wasn't very accurate. There were some years when no fish were reported being harvested, but newspaper articles would talk about, you know, 100 fish being harvested from the Missisquoi by one gang of anglers. So I'm not sure those records are accurate enough for us to estimate a population size.
So they were placed on the endangered list in 1972. What went into that decision?
Well, I wasn't involved with it, but I'm sure it was the dramatic decline, you know, that these spawning sites, people no longer found sturgeon at, you know, showing up to spawn at these sites anymore. The commercial catch by the few anglers still fishing them had dropped off pretty significantly by then. So the decline in the numbers seen in the commercial fishery and the fact that the biologists at the time just weren't seeing them in those spawning tributaries led to the concern that they were endangered.
Now, that commercial fishing operation is long gone. So why haven't we seen sturgeon rebound over this past half century?
Well, I think the biggest problem with the sturgeon recovery has been adult mortality. And that's really caused by two things. My major concern would be sea lamprey. Right. Sea lamprey, obviously, they've done some studies out in the Midwest, and sea lamprey cause mortality of those subadults, those fish between 24 inches and 3 feet. They also attack larger fish. When we began our project in 1998, we saw very large numbers of sea lamprey wounds on the lake sturgeon we were handling. And then the other possibility is that, you know, anglers, which occasionally capture one, just have to handle them, you know, correctly or gently so that those fish survive. But I think the biggest impediment to their recovery was the continued sea lamprey predation on those large fish.
We don't know how many sturgeon are in Lake Champlain right now. Why is that? Why don't we have an accurate count?
Well, it's very difficult to estimate a population size when you can't go in and sample a fish population with the same effort every year. And where we were catching fish was in these spawning tributaries. And you think about our rivers in the springtime. I could set nets one day and the flow may be 500 cubic feet per second. We could get a rain event and 2 days later the Winooski could be at 11,000 cubic feet per second. Huge fluctuations in flow. So we could never sample with the same effort from year to year, so you can't use that as a way to estimate population. And you can't do a marker capture on a lake sturgeon that may not come back for 5 years. You can't tag a fish and expect to catch it the next year, or maybe 5 years before it comes back. And then if it comes back, around a flood event, you're going to miss it anyway. So part of the work we're doing and was called for in the recovery plan was to, you know, develop a method, find out where these fish were in a more stable environment, either lower in the river or out in the lake, so that we could sample them effectively. And that will allow us to estimate population size eventually.
We've got a call from Jack from Burlington. Jack, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I came in kind of late, so this may have already been touched upon, but I was wondering a couple of things. As part of the recovery effort, are you growing fry sturgeon, small sturgeon, and releasing those? And then the next question is, what about trying to get a commercial caviar thing going? Because, I mean, I can't imagine it'd be that much different from beluga caviar, and that is pretty tasty stuff, and it could be a Vermont product, and you could, I just think it would probably sell.
Great questions, Jack. Thanks so much. Let's start with stocking. And are we using the hatcheries that Vermont has to then raise sturgeon fry and stock the like?
No, we're not stocking for a couple of reasons. One reason is that we don't have a brood source. We can't go out there and consistently capture females to use the Lake Champlain brood as a source of eggs for the system. Another problem is that I believe that the limiting factor is that adult mortality. So you could spend a lot of money in stock fish. If you don't get a handle on adult mortality, you're just feeding sea lamprey and, you know, it's a never-ending loop. You're not going to get ahead. And another problem with the stocking is that if we did start to select out a small group of adults to run that program, we'd be genetically selecting that population, we'd affect the diversity of the gene pool in Lake Champlain, and we just don't want to do that. You know, this is a recovering endangered species population that still has a healthy genetic makeup, and we don't want to start selecting out a smaller gene pool to boost the population.
And the second part of Jack's question was, could we have a caviar industry in Vermont?
Well, it would be an incredibly expensive project is set up. You know, we don't have enough we don't have a brood source here in Vermont, as I just described. You're talking about rearing a female for maybe 20 years in a hatchery system before you can harvest caviar. Some of the hatcheries in the West Coast using white sturgeon have got it down to 6, 7, or 8 years. But that whole time, you're rearing those fish until the time when you can harvest the caviar. And when you harvest the caviar, you kill the fish. You know, you have to kill the fish. Right. So those caviar farms out west are selling both the flesh and the eggs, and I just think it would be incredibly expensive to set something like that up in Vermont.
Interesting concept, but we're certainly not there at all. We're talking about the characteristics of the incredible lake sturgeon. Coming up, we'll hear about efforts to get an accurate census of them in Lake Champlain, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. There are some fascinating organisms on this earth, and one of them swims just offshore in Lake Champlain. It's the endangered lake sturgeon. We're learning more about the fish today from Chet McKenzie, Fisheries Program Manager for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. And one thing we've learned today is that we don't know how many lake sturgeon are actually out there in the lake right now. So joining us now to tell us about what's being done to rectify this is Lisa Izzo, a PhD student at UVM. Lisa, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Acoustic tagging was a method used to keep track of lake sturgeon, but you're stepping it up a notch. What are you doing to try to get an accurate count of these fish?
So the main part of my dissertation work is investigating the use of hydroacoustic methods to try and count lake sturgeon in Lake Champlain. And so hydroacoustic methods are different types of sonar that allow us to take an image of not only the lake bottom, but also the fish there and try and identify sturgeon and count them.
Well, it's a massive body of water, so do you have to scan basically the whole lake to get the number?
No, hopefully not. So the work that Vermont Fish and Wildlife has been doing with their acoustic tags has allowed us to identify different parts of the lake in different times of the year that we think these fish are closer together than they normally would be. And so we're using that information to try and figure out where they are and find them with the sonar equipment.
So there are more fish in the sea than sturgeon. How do you determine that what you're seeing is indeed sturgeon and that it's not the same 10 sturgeon you've already counted?
So sturgeon really lend themselves nicely to being surveyed with sonar equipment, and that is because they're so large and they have a really unique body shape, as Chet mentioned. They have that really nice shark-like tail, and all of these are characteristics that we can use to pinpoint what's a sturgeon on our images. And so we're using some of the information from the acoustic tags to try and figure out how much these fish are moving and basing our sonar surveys on that, so we're hopefully not surveying the same fish multiple times.
And Lisa, where are you now with the project, and what's the timeline for having a number once and for all?
So we are in our first field season right now. Winter is one of the times of year that we've identified as a good time to potentially survey these fish. So we've been going out on the lake for the since November, trying to just see if we can identify sturgeon. And we're showing some promising results so far. We think we found some. So we're just expanding on this project now. And hopefully within the next 4 years, we'll have a better idea of how many lake sturgeon are swimming around in Lake Champlain.
Well, you might be the first person on Earth to know exactly how many sturgeon are in Lake Champlain. It's pretty exciting. Lisa Izzo is a PhD student at UVM who's working to get us an accurate census of Lake Champlain, of the lake sturgeon in there. Thanks for being with us today, Lisa.
Thank you.
Chet, why is it important to know how many sturgeon are in the lake now, and what will you use with that data from Lisa Izzo?
Well, we've set population numbers in the recovery plan that we think would be stable or would sustain a population over time. And those numbers were selected based on population modeling that's been done through the Midwest or by looking at the numbers in these stable populations in lakes where sturgeon right now are considered to be healthy populations. So right now we've set these recovery goals, but we have no way of measuring progress. You know, are the populations declining, increasing, stable? And that's why we focus our effort on, you know, the acoustic study, which is allowing us to identify areas that where they may congregate. And then we've funded the work that Lisa's doing, which is to use the remote sensing sonars to see if we can get an accurate count.
Got a call from Shane, who's calling from Montpelier. Shane, thanks for joining us today. What's your question for Chet?
Thanks, Rick. I work with the Nature Conservancy here in Vermont, and the Nature Conservancy is working with a number of organizations to restore fish habitat connectivity throughout Vermont's rivers and streams. And Chet, I wanted to ask you, you spoke about the use of tributaries for spawning and the fishery, the historic fishery on the Missisquoi River, and I'm aware, and others are aware, of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service report that concludes that the removal of the Swanton Dam on the Missisquoi River would open up approximately 7.5 miles of habitat, including increasing the amount of spawning habitat by approximately 300 times. So I was just wondering what your take was on this study and just the issue of dams and their impediment to spawning habitat access, not only on the Missisquoi, but other tributaries to Lake Champlain.
Great question about dams on these tributaries.
Right. Thanks for the question, Shane. We know about Madeline Little's study. In fact, we support her findings, and we have advocated for the removal of the dam in Swanton for a number of years because we think it will not only benefit lake sturgeon by increasing the quantity of and quality of spawning habitat, but also the quantity of nursery habitat available. And during the relicensing of the Peterson Dam on the Lamoille, we raised concerns about the fact that so much spawning habitat had been lost once the Peterson Dam went in. Those are the two dams that seem to have had the largest impact on available spawning habitat and nursery habitat. We recently completed a study of the stretch of water downstream of the Peterson Dam on the Lamoille to see if we could do any type of in-stream habitat work to increase the quantity or quality of spawning habitat. And the engineering firm that just completed that work came to the conclusion, which I agree with, that – There really is no way to do that in that short stretch of stream without potentially impacting the area they're using now to spawn, because it's such a short stretch under lake influence, you know, lake level influence, that it's really a short stretch of water that provides the appropriate velocities and substrate. And they just didn't feel that with all their modeling and looking at the habitat that we could really get in there and do any sort of in-stream work to improve it. But that's one of the things identified in the recovery plan, is that spawning in nursery habitat is something we need to protect and increase when possible.
Well, short of removing dams, are fishways or fish ladders an answer for sturgeon?
No, they really aren't. Very few sturgeon pass through fishways. There are some people working on designing fishways which have been more successful, but you think about it, even if you pass a 6-foot adult upstream, now you have to design something to pass that 6-foot adult downstream, and you also have to pass those drifting fry, which are, you know, an inch and a quarter long, downstream through any sort of over any dam successfully. So really, there hasn't been a lot of success with lake sturgeon passage or even other species of sturgeon passage.
You've mentioned a few times the restoration plan. So let's get into that, Chet, and give us some more details, some specific points that are in the plan to restore the number of sturgeon in Lake Champlain.
Well, certainly it's already been talked about, but the habitat component of that recovery plan is to protect our existing habitat and try to improve what's there. That's really not focused on lake habitat, which we think is pretty healthy, but those spawning sites at in the tributaries. So one of the ways we do that is during a hydroelectric relicensing. We try to maintain natural flows during the spring spawning and incubation period, because lake sturgeon are sensitive to wide fluctuations in flow. So if you're running a peaking operation, which we still have on a few tributaries of Champlain, and you peak flows at night or during the daytime, you can drive adults away from spawning. You can also dewater eggs and leave eggs or larvae high and dry, depending on when the fish spawn. So we can improve flows. The talk about, you know, removing the Swanton Dam or providing passage over it to increase the quantity of spawning in nursery habitat is important.
What kind of education efforts do you need to undertake as far as the plan?
I think the education effort we're trying to undertake and spend the most time on is just to inform anglers about how important these adults are and how to handle those fish properly so that they can be released and survive. When you think about a fish that may only spawn once every 5 years but may live for the next 60 years, it's important that we handle those adults, which are critical to any type of recovery. So that's a big part of it.
So if I catch a sturgeon, what should I do?
Well, if you can, it would be nice to unhook that sturgeon, leaving it in the water, not picking it up on the ledges, as some people have sent me pictures of. They're pretty rugged fish, so I think they can survive that. But the best thing to do is handle them properly by leaving them in the water if possible. If you have to remove it out of the water, support its body, and then get it back in the water quickly. Try to remove the hook. Usually lake sturgeon seem to be hooked in the lips. I've heard that from talking to researchers in the Midwest, and recently every angler that's called with a report, we've asked them where was the fish hooked, and they seem to get hooked in those protrusible mouths, so you can remove the hook. But if it's deeply hooked, just cut your line, leave the hook in the fish, and release it quickly. And then it's also important for us to at least hear about where you caught that fish. If you have a picture, we'd like to see it to confirm it's a sturgeon. So anglers can help. In fact, we have a fish with an acoustic tag with it this year that was caught in Otter Creek, the first fish we've caught, adult sturgeon we've caught in Otter Creek, and we got an acoustic tag in it. And the only reason we got that fish was because an angler called, said he had caught it there. We pulled our gear from the Winooski, rushed down there the next day and caught that, maybe not that sturgeon, but caught a sturgeon. We were able to document that they're in Otter Creek spawning and getting an acoustic tag in it. So now we're tracking where that fish moves on Lake Champlain.
Tell us again what success looks like for the state's restoration program for lake sturgeon.
Well, we would certainly like to see a minimum of 2,000 adults in Lake Champlain itself. We have targets set for particular river populations. If we could get 750 adults that just use the Winooski, that would also be a measure of success. And those numbers were picked on picked based on population models, which have looked at survival rates and, you know, length of or their age and their life history, and also those stable fisheries out in the Midwest.
Is the lake habitat stable and suitable for a larger population of these sturgeon?
The lake habitat, there is a lot of lake habitat available. That littoral zone that they seem to like, the deltas off of these river mouths, it could sustain a lot more sturgeon than we see now because they did historically.
And the problems we've had with the lake, things like phosphorus runoff, the blue-green algae, does that affect these lake sturgeon in any ways that that are problematic?
No, I really don't know the answer to that. Certainly areas where we're tracking fish, blue-green algal blooms and, you know, those things haven't occurred there. So in those places where we've been able to track sturgeon through the inland sea or in the main lake, those issues about phosphorus loading and blue-green algae don't seem to be as significant of a problem.
Got another call. Art is calling us from Barton. Art, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yeah, another question, just a little family history. My mom and her two sisters grew up on the East Coast, and one of the sisters back in the 40s moved out to Oregon. And starting probably in the 50s maybe, every once in a while the West Coast aunt would send, or a sister would send, some little tuna fish cans of kippered sturgeon. And my parents would keep that for only the most special of little parties or get-togethers or dinner parties. They wouldn't break that stuff out unless it was something really important. And, of course, I was a fussy eater as a kid, so I never had any of it. But I'm sure it was pretty darn good stuff, and it was called kippered sturgeon.
Wow. Have you ever had it, Chet, yourself?
Not kippered sturgeon, but I certainly have sturgeon. I actually attended a World Congress on sturgeon restoration, I don't know, back in the 1990s or 2000, and I was in Wisconsin, and people from all over the world were there. And I remember walking in the first night to the reception, and there were bowls of caviar across the table and bowl and all sorts of plates of different sturgeon smoked and whatever, broiled and whatever. And I remember thinking most of us there were working from North America, working on sturgeon recovery projects. And here they had people from China and Russia, and basically we feasted on sturgeon. So I've had sturgeon there, and it certainly is good to eat. I'm not a great fan of caviar, but I of course had to try it because who gets a chance to do that? Yeah. So I took the chance.
Chet McKenzie is the Fisheries Program Manager for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. I want to thank you for filling us in today on Lake Sturgeon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Vermont Edition has done a lot of math shows in the past. Next, we'll talk to a high school mathematics teacher who is the reigning Teacher of the Year in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Even for math lovers, having to take algebra, geometry, trigonometry, calculus, and/or statistics in high school might not be the most enjoyable thing because you're squeezing it all in with all those other subjects and gym and being a teenager. So hats off to high school math teachers everywhere, but particularly to Kate McCann, who teaches high school mathematics at U32 Middle and High School in East Middlebury. She was recently named Vermont's Teacher of the Year. Kate McCann, congratulations and welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much. It's they don't say gym anymore. It's physical education.
Oh, that's right. I've just dated myself, haven't I?
And I'm in East Montpelier.
Oh, and where did I say?
I think you said East Middlebury.
Oh, well, let's get it right on the map. East Montpelier.
Right in central Vermont. You got it.
I know where it is. I apologize for that. Well, Kate, teaching was not exactly what you set out to do with your career. So how did it become your profession?
Well, when I was in middle school, I had an amazing math teacher, Lynn Notari, at Lancaster Elementary School in New Hampshire. And she encouraged participation in math counts. Math Counts provides engaging math programs to U.S. middle school students of all ability levels in order to build confidence and improve attitudes towards math and problem solving. I really enjoyed that experience. I love being part of the team. I loved competing. I loved spending extra hours doing math problems in preparation for competition. And I loved the core group of students that made up the team. And I knew then that I would go on to further study mathematics at college or university. So I went to the University of Vermont, where I was fast approaching a bachelor's degree in mathematics, and it became clear that I was going to have to make some sort of choice about which career to pursue, because unfortunately remaining an undergrad wasn't exactly a viable option for a career. So I took on a year of service with AmeriCorps and did some great work with youth at risk in the Northeast Kingdom. Some of the work was in the classroom, but most of it was exploring the great outdoors. And it was during that time that I began turning my attention to teaching young people and making that life's work. I was also encouraged in my senior year at UVM by a senior lecturer, Leah Cravati, to explore education and take a couple of courses. And one of those courses actually put me in the classroom, and I never left.
Well, what was it about math that really just kind of fired you up, Kate?
Math, to me, is about problem solving. And we all have decisions to make, no matter who we are, whether we're students or parents or in the workforce or whatever it is. We face problems every day that need solving. And I think, to me, math is problem-solving-based learning that incorporates learning from both our successes and our failures.
So what are some of your students working on or learning that has really excited the mentor in you?
Right now in geometry, we've moved on from looking at rigid motions to working with non-rigid motion transformations. So we're looking at dilating figures. And right now we're looking at the fact that when through a dilation, a segment maps to a segment and a line maps to a line and a triangle maps to a triangle. And they're able to experience that with a little bit of work and the use of their geometric construction tools, the compass and straight edge.
Well, if I can use a little statistics on you, I think about 6% of our listeners exactly understand what you're talking about on that example. So math can be, though, a struggle for some. And, I'm wondering, how you relate to the student who doesn't get math or doesn't understand how this will ever be applicable in their lives. How do you get them engaged?
Yeah, it's difficult. Like that's probably our biggest challenge is engagement. And for me, it's about making close personal connections. And if they can buy into the fact that I really care about them, they're a little bit more willing to put in some extra time, either after school or during the callback slot that we have, and just really sort of work through it and persevere in the problem solving.
You're Teacher of the Year for 2017 in Vermont. So as Teacher of the Year, what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, first, I just want to say it's a humbling experience. I'm really proud to be among those who have been honored with this award in the past. And I see it as an opportunity to be heard and to make a difference. So two of the things that I'm really sort of pushing since I have the floor is the statewide math fair that the Vermont Council of Teachers of Mathematics is going to sponsor this spring, and also my belief that more and more teachers should seek and take part in the process to become nationally board certified.
Now, what happens at a math fair?
Well, I'm not really sure. We're modeling this math fair after the work that's being done by the North Carolina Council of Teachers of Mathematics. And I sort of envision it to be similar to the old science fairs, except that I don't remember when I took part in the science fair actually interacting with the judges. And so there will be an interaction component part of this where a student gets interested in something, registers by February 17th to take part in the math fair, brings their project to the math fair on March 25th at the University of Vermont, and then puts that project up on display with the proper research that they've done and their supporting work and evidence, and then speaks to the judges. The judges will have the opportunity to talk to them about their project and also ask questions about what it is that they see.
Now, the other thing you said that's important to you is national board certification. Why is that important?
Well, for me, what board certification does is allows a teacher to hone their practice, showcase their talent in the classroom, and really demonstrate their dedication to their students and their profession.
I don't know what they give you, a crown or a sash or anything as Teacher of the Year, but I do know that you'll be heading to Washington, D.C. to meet the president and the other state's Teachers of the Year. So what are you looking forward to on that trip?
Well, before that trip, there's actually a trip to Dallas that's coming up in a few weeks in February, and I'm really looking forward to that trip. That'll be the start of it all, the induction process into Teacher of the Year, and I'll have the opportunity to meet all of the state Teachers of the Year at that time. In Washington, I was recently there this past fall when I was awarded a presidential award for excellence in teaching math and science, and that gave me an opportunity to meet with the senator. I actually got to spend some time with Senator Leahy, and that was wonderful. We got a little tour of the building and whatnot. And sometimes it's just to meet people and start creating a system of networking.
What do you know about some of the other states' Teachers of the Year?
I know that one of them is a world-renowned artist, and I can't wait to meet her.
Oh, that's fantastic.
She actually is one of the four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year. So I'm excited just to hear what they're doing in their classroom and how they've made connections with kids and some of their strategies that they learn or strategies they use in the classroom to engage students and really just, you know, highlight what we're doing here in Vermont, but also pick and choose some things to bring back.
Kate McCann is a high school math teacher at U32 Middle and High School, and she's Vermont's 2017 Teacher of the Year. Congratulations and thank you, Kate.
Thank you so much.
Today, music is everywhere. Invisible signals fly through the air carrying every possible genre and style that a person could ever want. We can access them from our homes, cars, and phones, enjoying content from around the world. In this installment of the series Timeline, VPR Classical host James Stewart reminds us how far we've come.
In the 19th century, this type of technology was just a dream in the minds of scientists and inventors. But the 20th century saw an explosion of communication and the rise of a device we call the radio. The idea of wireless transmission began in the laboratories of Heinrich Rudolf Hertz and Nikola Tesla in the late 1800s. They established the theory of Hertzian or radio waves and demonstrated their properties. However, it was believed that these signals had a very limited range. Oxford professor Oliver Lodge estimated that radio waves would only be able to travel, at the most, a mile or so. That didn't stop Italian scientist and inventor Guglielmo Marconi from experimenting with commercial applications of this technology. In the 1890s, he experimented with various transmitters and receivers, boosting their range with each breakthrough. At the end of 1901, his team successfully sent a signal from Cornwall, England, to Newfoundland, crossing the Atlantic and proving the true potential of the technology. For his work, he received a Nobel Prize. And in 1912, a sinking Titanic used Marconi's wireless telegraph to send a distress signal, and 700 lives were saved. In the teens, radio signals were merely the dit-das of Morse code, used for navigation and communication, especially at sea. Then on Christmas Eve, 1906, a signal was sent from Brant Rock, Massachusetts. Boats all across the Atlantic heard the carol "O Holy Night" played on the violin and a human voice singing and reading from the Bible. Many believe that this was the first audio broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, his master's voice of the air.
In the 1920s, technology improved from crystal receivers to vacuum tubes and the ability to focus the frequency of a signal.
This is KB.
In just two short years, 600 radio stations appeared across the United States alone, offering a wide variety of programming, from news to information, and of course, music. These wireless concerts, as they were called, allowed anyone with a receiver to listen. You didn't have to buy the recording or go to the performance, you just had to flip the switch. Radio signals flew through geographical and cultural boundaries, exposing a generation of listeners to sounds, songs, and expression beyond their reach. This communication technology helped shape the culture of the 20th century. Find out more about the history of radio and follow the timeline at vpr.net/timeline.
That's VPR Classical's James Stort. Timeline is an exploration into the development of Western music. Follow the link he suggested to check out all the episodes, including a recent one on the history of recorded sound. And the link is vpr.net/timeline. Vermont's new governor, Phil Scott, is our guest tomorrow on Vermont Edition. First thing tomorrow morning, he's announcing his plan to sell his construction company in response to concerns about conflicts of interest. We'll talk about that and the major policy initiatives that Scott laid out in his inaugural address last week: education, budget, and health care. Send your questions for Governor Scott to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Rick Sengary. Thanks for listening.